Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we discuss letters and letter collections, and with us is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Nelson Richel, humanities professor at Mass Maritime Academy. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning.
All right, so letters tell us a lot, not only about the personalities and relationships of the writers, but their great historical significance in letters.
This is very true, and it is very interesting to see how letter writing has changed over the years. I think one of the most alarming things at the moment that is alarming a lot of people is that people will stop writing letters mm-hmm. because of email. There must be at least 6 books out now about how this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. However, it turns out that this has been something people have been worried about far longer than pre-internet, that people were going to stop writing letters. And so I think it is, however, a really rich reading experience. And for those of you that don't want to spend a lot of time reading paper, you can read just 2 or 3 letters and it will be fine. Yeah. You will still get some wonderful information and some wonderful history and wonderful letters about how people interact with one another.
Yeah. I just want to like look at letters of somebody that I'm thinking that you admire historically, and or even like some of the letters you'd have from some of the ship captains and things. It really gives you shines a lot of light into whatever time period we're talking about.
Absolutely. I always think it's very interesting to look at letters written by writers themselves. Mm. And even if it's just looking at the mundane letters, that house shopping or groceries, but then when they write about their own work, which is sometimes rare, or when they write to other authors and becomes a dialogue and sometimes very surprising connection between authors that normally we probably wouldn't associate with each other.
So what's your first book, Jill?
Well, my first book is one of these books that used to be very often on your shelf, and you might have seen one when you were a child. This one is called The World's Great Letters, which I felt I had to bring just as sort of a historic bit of letter writing. This is actually a treasury of The World's Great Letters. I saw this when I was on vacation once on somebody else's bookshelf, and I thought of it when we were doing the show, and I thought, surely nobody is going to have this book in a library, but thank you, Brewster Ladies Library, for still having a copy of A Treasury of the World's Great Letters. This came out in 1940, and I have to say that in this book, it is already talking about the demise of letter writing. And the author writes in his intro, "The belief that the telegraph and telephone killed the art of letter writing is, in my opinion, without foundation." And indeed, he was right about that. It also has a great section on love letters, which are one of my favorite kind of letters, but there are all kinds, as you say. There are lots of historic letters as well. And this is really sort of funny. This is, again, from the intro. "One of the most discerning critics I know dismisses all love letters as silly. The probable explanation is that he thinks that love itself is silly." Hmm. And they talk about 2 strange facts I discovered in this phase of my investigation. First, that with a few exceptions, geniuses like Beethoven, conquerors like Napoleon, and great creative scientists like Michael Faraday all say pretty much the same romantic, grandiloquent, and sometimes incoherent things when they sit down to write love letters. Second, that in Venezuela, the post office permits love letters to go through the mails at half rate, provided they are sent in bright red envelopes. So, and this gives you a real overview of the kind of letters that were written. It is primarily male. There aren't very many women letter writers in this book. It starts from 334 BC to AD 1675.
Wow.
Letters of not so long ago, 1747 to 1896, and ends in 1937. So a very sort of historic look at what kind of letters can show up. And this is a nice collection just for if you want to read one letter and you're not so interested in the entire life or the entire story. It is The Treasury of the World's Great Letters.
All right. Nelson, what's your first book?
It's interesting to contemplate whether in 50, 60 years will there be a collection of the great emails.
Yeah, right.
I thought I would start with Jane Austen. And this is Jane Austen's letters. One of the aspects of Austen is that she intensely disliked the Prince Regent, who would become George IV after once George, his father George III passed away in 1820. The irony of that, was that the Prince Regent was a great admirer of Austin's and had also been very interested in the arts, sponsored much, and architecture and so forth. So this is the letter that Austin wrote to her sister-in-law, Mary Lloyd, in February 1813. And it particularly refers to the Prince Regent. His wife he had married early on, basically because he had run up gambling debts of 600,000 pounds in the 1790s, which we can only imagine what that would relate to today. And the English Parliament would only bail him out if he married. So he married his first cousin. They quickly had a child, but they did not like each other. And she went to Europe and lived there. The child, Princess Charlotte, at one point, the Prince Regent took control of her. And he had the right because, of course, women, even a princess the wife of the Prince Regent, did not have rights to her child. And so he had took total control of her. And so and this was got into a lot of public publicity because Caroline wrote to the Speaker of the House of Commons, and then he read it in session, and then it became public knowledge. And so this is where Austin writes about this. She says, "I suppose all the world is sitting in judgment upon the Princess of Wales." Princess of Wales's letter. "Poor woman, I shall support her as long as I can, because she is a woman, and because I hate her husband, but I can hardly forgive her for calling herself attached and affectionate to a man whom she must detest. I do not know what to do about it, but if I must give up the princess, I am resolved to at least always think that she would have been respectable if the prince had behaved only tolerably to her from the first." And when her novel Emma came out, the Prince Regent made it clear that he would like her, it would be fine with him if she would dedicate the volume to him. And so it was after a lot of pushing from her publisher, she eventually agreed to do that. And she wrote the dedication is rather sarcastic, I think. "To His Royal Highness, the Prince Regent, this work is by His Royal Highness's permission, most respectfully dedicated by His Royal Highness's dutiful and obedient humble servant, the author." So there is some evidence of the last few years that there's a receipt that for her first novel, when it came out, that it was sold 2 days before it was sold publicly, and it was the Prince Regent purchased it. So he may have been her first person to buy one of her books.
Right. And the name of the book again is?
It's Jane Austen's Letters.
It is the book conversation this morning. We are talking about letters and letter collections. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson Richel, humanities professor at Mass Maritime Academy. Today it's books on letters and letter collections. Jill, what's next?
My next book is a book I could spend the whole hour talking about, which is The Letters of E.B. White. This is the revised edition.
Love E.B. White.
I know you do. And I had not actually read his letters. You know, we've talked about his essays before, but I had not read his letters. This particular edition has a foreword by John Updike. And this is this wonderful author's note, which the author being E.B. White at the beginning, saying, "Ideally, a book of letters should be published posthumously. The advantages are obvious. The editor enjoys a free hand and the author enjoys a perfect hiding place, the grave, where he is impervious to embarrassments and beyond the reach of libel. I have failed to cooperate in this ideal arrangement. Through some typical bit of mismanagement, I am still alive, and the book has had to adjust to that awkward fact."
Oh, he's such a great sense of humor.
He's very funny. And one of the great things about this particular collection of letters is the index. And I found when going through a lot of these books of letters that I was looking at for this show is that there are really, really great indexers out there in the world, or were. I don't know that they still exist. A lot of it is not even done anymore. A lot of books get published without indexes. But in the case of this particular indexer, it is just a fabulous collection. For example, one of the indexes is for, there's includes pets. And so there is a list in the index of all of his pet-related comments. So you have alligators, crow, Daisy, Scottish Terrier dog, Ezekiel, children, pets, Fred, Jenny, James Thurber, Scottish Terrier dog. I mean, it goes on and on with all the pets. And the same is true of birds, because he loved birds. Mm-hmm. And so in the bird section, there's bobwhites, canaries, catbirds, Cornell program, crows, and so forth and so on. So the indexer did this sort of incredible job of putting these things together. And here's one little bit about birds from E.B. White letter, which was to someone named Edwin Way Teal. This is from May 3rd, 1950. Dear Mr. Teal, yes, I remember the passage in the Thoreau journals and was amused to read it again. I'm afraid it doesn't quite fit our fascinating news story department, but thanks for sending it. Saw a brown thrasher in my backyard in 48th Street this morning between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. Each year I see about a dozen migrants in this small green enclosure, robin, jay, scarlet tanager, hermit, or olive black back thrush, towhee, thrasher, white throat, he was here 3 days ago, and a few warblers. They arrive like traveling salesmen, spend a night or two, and then depart. And I always wonder whether I'm looking at the same individual that I saw a year ago. Am I? Sincerely, E.B. White. He also has a great letter on here in here on freedom of speech. And of course, he talks a lot about his books. There is a wonderful letter about the ending of Stuart Little, where he writes to somebody who has written to him, Dear Mrs. Sanborn, the ending of Stuart Little has plagued me, not because I think there is anything wrong with it, but because children seem to insist on having life neatly packaged. The final chapters were written many years after the early chapters, and I think this did affect the narrative to some extent. I was sick and was under the impression that I had only a short time to live, and so I may have brought the story to a more abrupt close than I would have under different circumstances. My reason, if indeed I had any, for leaving Stuart in the midst of his quest, was to indicate that questing is more important than finding. Mm. He writes, there's a very funny letter in here that he writes to a librarian because
of
she has complained.
You're gonna pick up the librarian letter.
And he's very, she's very upset because she thinks he's written a letter to one of her students that wasn't appropriate. And he writes back to her, which is really a fabulous letter as well about children and books and what children can or cannot read or understand when they are reading. And of course, lots about the Charlotte's Web. Mm. So you hear a lot about all of his books, but also just what is around him. And that is the great thing about every collection of letters, really, is again, that sort of personal stuff that you don't normally get in their writing.
Right. And can I say, I miss indexes. I can't remember.
I was looking something.
I was looking at a book the other day. I don't remember what it was in the index. I'm like, where's the index?
Yeah. It's a little scary.
Yeah. All right, Nelson, what's next?
Next, what I'm going to look at are two books with two different writers who actually corresponded rather briefly. And this is maybe a little surprising, but of course they were contemporaries. One is Arthur Conan Doyle and the other is Oscar Wilde. Huh. And so in 1899, Wilde and Doyle were both invited to a dinner in London by the editor of Lippincott's monthly magazine, which came out of Philadelphia, but it was sold in Britain, as well, of course, through the U.S. And Conan Doyle wrote about this after the meeting after it, or the dinner. And he said, already famous as a champion of aestheticism, it was indeed a golden evening for me. Wilde, to my surprise, had read Micah Clark, one of Conan Doyle's novels, and was enthusiastic about it, so that I did not feel a complete outsider. His conversation left an indelible impression upon my mind. He towered above us all and yet had the art of seeming to be interested in all that we could say. A result of this dinner was Conan Doyle's the second Sherlock Holmes story, The Sign of Four, was published through Lippincott, and Oscar Wilde's the first version of The Picture of Dorian Gray was published there. And so Conan Doyle, once the Dorian Gray was heavily attacked by the London press. It was denounced as being immoral and obscene and so forth. And Conan Doyle wrote to Wilde and praised it. We don't have that letter, but we have Wilde's letter back to Doyle. And he writes, "Between me and life, there is a mist of worlds away. I throw probability out the window for the sake of a phrase, and the chance of an epigram makes me dissent truth. Still, I am at making a work of art, and I am really delighted that you think my treatment subtle and artistically good. The newspapers seem to me to be written by the purient for the Philistine. I cannot understand how they can treat Dorian Gray as immoral. My difficulty was to keep the inherent moral subordinate to the artistic and dramatic effect, and it still seems to me that the moral is too obvious." Then that letter was from April 1891. It's rather interesting. And this is from a book, Oscar Wilde, A Life in Letters, actually edited by his grandson, Merlin Holland. Yeah. And there is one other letter that might be just a brief snippet from it, from March 1899. So this is after Wilde had been imprisoned and he's released. And he's in Switzerland at the time. And he was doing a lot of, because he had financial difficulties, staying with various friends and so on. And some treated him well, some did not. And he writes to his friend Robert Ross and of a realization that he had. "I used to rely on my personality. Now I know that my personality really rested on the fiction of position. Having lost position, I find my personality of no avail." It's sort of an interesting take from Wilde.
And again, the two books are?
Arthur Conan Doyle, A Life in Letters, and Oscar Wilde, A Life in Letters. So two lives in letters. So
interesting.
Lives in letters.
Yeah. Jill?
Well, I brought a life in letters, as it were, as well, which is called A Literate Passion, Letters of Anais Nin and Henry Miller, 1932 to 1953. And these letters, as one reviewer wrote, are so packed with questing passions that real life pales alongside. On paper, these are lovers who should go down to history with the likes of Eloise and Abelard. Their real lives were tumultuous and guarded, as they were both married to someone else, Nin to Hugh Nin, a banker, and Miller to June Miller, a neurotic alcoholic. But in their letters, they met with surprising openness, and they wrote letters all the time. And you would think that the whole fire would sort of dim a little bit, but it does not seem to. Here is one of his early ones. This is from Henry Miller to Anais. "Nin, 3 minutes after you have gone." Now, again, he's sitting down 3 minutes after she has left his presence. "3 minutes after you have gone. No, I can't restrain it. I tell you what you already know. I love you. It is this I destroyed over and over again. At Dijon, I wrote you long, passionate letters. If you had remained in Switzerland, I would have sent them. But how could I send them to Louvain? Anais, I can't say much now. I am in a fever. I could scarcely talk to you because I was continually on the point of getting up and throwing my arms around you. I wish I was in hopes you wouldn't have to go home for dinner, that we might go somewhere to dine and dance. You dance. I've dreamed of that over and over. I dancing with you, or you alone dancing with head thrown back and eyes half shut." And this goes on and on for pages. I mean, he has one theme, really, and it is his passion for her. But what was really funny, I found a really funny thing about Provincetown in here. I did not know that Anais Nin, this is the thing about letters. You're always, you never know what it might lead you to. And this is a letter that I had no idea Anais Nin had been in Provincetown in July 1941. And she's writing to Henry, and she writes, "Got your cheerful and serene letter from Camino Palmero, so I see that my suggestion was the right one, and that was what you most wanted to do. Yes, this is like a marin, but it is also a frigidaire. I had to send for my winter coat and woolen dresses." She's writing this in July 1941. "I came dressed for Cuba, and the tropical dream which haunts me and which I can never fulfill came to a country of tight-lipped New Englanders who denounced me to the police because I took off my brassiere on the beach about 5 miles from human eyes." So she was not too happy with Provincetown at that. So you never know what you're going to find in a collection of letters. And that, I think, is one of the other really fabulous things about them. She also has a very great love, which she goes to New York City and has a wonderful time there. She writes, "I'm in love with New York. When you bring your own riches to it, it is like drinking from a Venetian glass. It is beautiful, vital, and magical. magical when I walked into a restaurant, the door opened by itself, magically. You have to know how to use the magic of New York, how to swim in its Babylonian proportions. I love it. It's made for great swoops and daring and for hope in life. It is full of hope, full of beauty and dancing and lights and polish and a lovely thing to play with one's own self, to color with one's own mood. I tell you, it is a beautiful material, worked so feverishly, so frenetically. I did not write you more, but I will tonight. And she does. And she goes on and writes another whole letter about New York and how much she loves it. But really very passionate love letters called A Literate Passion, Letters of Anais Nin and Henry Miller, 1932 to 1953.
Oh, interesting. All right, Nelson, what's your next book?
Well, next is that I brought in is Edith Wharton. And this is The Letters of Edith Wharton. And I thought that it might be some listeners who would be interested in a letter regarding Wharton's The Mount, the house that she and her husband at the time, Teddy, had in Lenox, Massachusetts. And of course, it's still a wonderful museum now, and it's a wonderful place to spend a day. And so this is a letter from August 26, 1911, that Wharton wrote to her friend Sarah Norton, and she discusses the mount. And now, up to this point, her husband had been going through a lot of psychological issues, and he seemed to be going in a more or less on a mend, but he eventually they separated, and his condition deteriorated. We have had a very large offer for the mount since I last wrote you, and I have very suddenly decided to sell it. The reasons are partly economic and partly based on Teddy's condition. The place is very expensive, so much so that it requires constant care and adjustment to keep it from being too much so, and with a big country place, you know how hard it is to maintain that balance. Still, I was prepared to do it if Teddy had felt disposed to manage the place, as he was eager to do so at one time. When it came to the point, however, he said with Reynolds, their favorite gardener, gone, he felt he was not well and dreaded the constant responsibility. He is so much better mentally and morally that we were able to survey the whole field quietly and impartially, and I left the decision entirely to him, except I was rather on the side of keeping the place, if possible. So, you know, sort of a... And she has a whole series of letters. Interestingly, she has a different take on the selling of the mount to different friends. So, but that's, you know, humans will do that.
Yeah. And the name of that book is?
This is The Letters of Edith Wharton, edited by R.W.B. Lewis and Nancy Lewis.
We are talking about letters and letter collections, and we will talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about letters and letter collections with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson Richel, humanities professor at Mass Maritime Academy. You know, it's interesting looking at the books here on the table. They're quite hefty. These are not small books. There's a lot of letters in these books.
There are. And if people are really communicating, that's how their primary form of communication is, they're going to write a lot of letters.
A lot of letters. And I think this is probably the largest book.
And this largest book is, in fact, a book of letters, but it is a fictional book of letters. And I really, when we decided to do the show on letters, the first book I thought of was this book. Perhaps because it took my reading friend and I, 3 years. It took us a long time to read this aloud. And perhaps the only way to read this book is to read it aloud. This is Clarissa by Samuel Richardson. And it is one of the first, if not the first, what are known as epistolary novels. And this is a whole genre of novel in which the entire thing presumably is written in letters from one person to another. And one of the things it does is, of course, it gives many different points of view as you're writing them. But in this case, this actually was named as one of the 100 best novels, number 4 by The Guardian newspaper. And they write, after Pilgrim's Progress and Robinson Crusoe, the next landmark in English fiction is a towering monument of approximately 970,000 words, Clarissa, the longest novel in the English canon. To Samuel Johnson, it was simply the first book in the world for the knowledge it displays of the human heart. Most critics agree that it is one of the greatest European novels whose influence casts a long shadow. And Clarissa is a tragic heroine pressured by her unscrupulous family to marry a wealthy man, and she has other ideas. And as a result, she runs away with this no-good man who is really horrible, but you don't really know how horrible he is till you get sort of towards the end of the book. But the entire thing is written in letters. And in this case, they are writing letters pretty much, you know, three times a day. This is not, you know, I'm going to write one great letter. This is, I have to write today after. And the whole, probably the first third of the novel, is letters between Miss Howe to Miss Clarissa Harlowe. And Miss Howe is her best friend and is the person that sort of is keeping her tethered to the world. And she writes, this is letter 12, Miss Howe to Miss Clarissa Harlowe, Thursday morn, March 2nd. And I love that every letter has a date and or time so that you can really get the sense of how often they are writing letters. She writes, indeed, you would not be in love with him for the world, your servant, my dear, nor would I have you, for I think with all the advantages of person, fortune, and family, he is not by any means worthy of you, and this opinion I give as well from the reasons you mention, which I cannot but confirm, as from what I have heard of him but a few hours ago from Mrs. Fortescue, a favorite of Lady Betty Lawrence, who knows him well. But let me congratulate you, however, on your being the first of our sex that ever I heard who has been able to turn that lion, love, at her own pleasure into a lap dog. however, it does not end that well. And one of the oddest things about this novel and this letters that are going back and forth is that almost from the very beginning, they are waiting for this guy named her cousin Morden. And you keep thinking that when cousin Morden shows up, everything's going to be okay, because you've waited two-thirds. You know, you're probably at page 900 before you actually cousin Morden shows up. But he's in the letters over and over and over again. And unfortunately, when he shows up, things do not actually get better for her. And you also have all the letters from Lovelace, who he is writing to his best friend, John Belford. And they are just terrible. I mean, he's a terrible, terrible guy. And so you have letter after letter about him being really terrible. Here is just one little bit. It is a maxim with some that if they are left alone with a woman and make not an attempt upon her, she will think herself affronted. Are not such men as these worse than I am? What an opinion must they have of the whole sex? Let me defend the sex I so dearly love. If these elder brethren of ours think they have general reason for their assertion, they must have kept very bad company, or must judge of women's hearts by their own. She must be an abandoned woman who will not shrink as a snail into its shell at a gross and sudden attempt. For my own part, I have been always decent in the company of women till I was sure of them, nor have I ever offered a great offense till I have found little ones passed over, and that they shunned me not when they knew my character. My divine Clarissa has puzzled me and beat me out of my play. It is a really upsetting novel. And again, it takes forever to read. I don't know how many people have actually... There's an abridged version of this that has come out. But the abridged version would not do it justice, because you have to
be really involved
with that letter writing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to truly appreciate how horrible he is and how terribly silly and wrongheaded she is, and how terrible her family is for letting her get as far into all of this as they do. It is called Clarissa by Samuel Richardson.
Mm-hmm. All right, Nelson.
Well, it's always interesting to think that for over a century, a lot of urban areas would have mail delivery three times a day. So you could write a letter in the morning. The recipient would have it noon, and you could write back, and they would have the answer, or you would have, you know, you just keep going back, and you know, it's interesting with that type of.
Well, it was essentially the email of its time, right. And so because you could get answers back and forth in one day, and there was a great uproar when the postal service went to once a day because how could you?
And when it's multiple days, it's not that unlike the emails.
Yeah, exactly.
If, you know, we think about that. So this is Letters of Virginia Woolf. There's 9 volumes, all in the Falmouth Library. A lot of Woolf's letters are, you know, sort of daily activities and so on, but she does get into some writing. But I thought this would be sort of interesting. In 1907, when she was still Virginia Stephen, she and her brother, Adrian, were looking for a house to live in. And so they're in London. So I'm going to read from a few letters where she gets into this house hunting. She says, "I have found a house in Fitzroy Square. Bernard Shaw and his mother lived there for many years. There are the usual intricacies, but Adrian is rather eager. And I don't think we shall do much better. Still, this is only a phantom so far." Wolf, her writing often challenged notions of society of being respectable. Yet respectability becomes a big issue of this house. Today, Fitzroy Square's affluent area, but in early 20th century, not so much. And Shaw and his mother had lived there for decades. Shaw had left it in 1898 when he married, but his mother lived there till 1907. Okay, well, this is another letter a few days later, and these are like the next 2 days later, and this is, again, April 1907. She writes, "How am I to judge, or what importance ought I to attach to respectability? There is a boys' college on one side, a doctor on the other. There are hospitals and institutions at intervals, nursing homes. Bernard Shaw or his mother was the last tenant. The streets surrounding are dingy, but no worse than they are where I should say." And then the next day, so these are all to her friend Violet Dickinson. And she goes, "Well, the worst of it is that it seems so impossible to make a good decision. Suppose that things are as Mrs. Shaw says, would they really be so unpleasant as to make the house untenable? And she goes in this, "We have waited. I can't go into all the reasons and emotions. Anyhow, the thing isn't settled, and we try to come to a clear judgment. Only it is about as difficult as it can be. Jack writes, it is, he believes, perfectly respectable. Shaw, the builder," and they had the builder that they had to remodel was also named Shaw. "The builder says he would send his own wife there. The square itself is all right, but he has gone to ask the police station. I shall hear the results tomorrow. It's no use writing. Of course, it's damnable, disappointing." And she did take the house, and she lived there for a number of years.
She thought a lot about it, didn't she?
Yeah. And looking at it, I don't think it was a plus that Shaw and his mother had been there for a while. She only later on, decades later, did she come to have an understanding and sort of like Shaw.
But. That's the Letters of Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, Letters of Virginia Woolf.
Well, and speaking of the Letters of Virginia Woolf, I have to bring up the letters of Vita Sackville-West. And there has been a volume published just of Vita Sackville-West's love letters to Virginia Woolf, or correspondence, not all love letters, but many love letters. And there is this little volume I have in my hand right now called Love Letters, which in fact includes a couple of the Vita Sackville-West letters. Although what is very funny about this is one of them is this passionate love letter to Virginia Woolf, written in 1927. But then Vita Sackville-West also makes an appearance with a love letter to Violet Trefusis, which was written in, 1950. So Vita Sackville-West, this is the thing about letters, right? If somebody has saved them and people you have written them to, be careful, because you might want to be careful about who you send these letters to and promise them. I actually have been sent, people have sent me letters back that I have written to them because they had, they had so many and they didn't want to throw them out. And so I didn't want them. What am I supposed to do with all these old letters I wrote you, 20 years ago? But this is a beautiful letter that she wrote to Vita Sackville-West, did write to Virginia Woolf, 1927. "I am reduced to a thing that wants Virginia. I composed a beautiful letter to you in the sleepless nightmare hours of the night, and it is all gone. I just miss you in a quite simple, desperate human way. You, with all your undumb letters, would never write so elementary a phrase as that. Perhaps you wouldn't even feel it. And yet I believe you'll be sensible of a little gap, but you'd clothe it in so exquisite a phrase that it would love a little of its reality. Whereas with me, it is quite stark. I miss you even more than I could have believed believed, and I was prepared to miss you a good deal. So this letter is just really a squeal of pain. It is incredible how essential to me you have become. I suppose you are accustomed to people saying these things. Damn you, spoilt creature. I shan't make you love me any the more by giving myself away like this. But oh, my dear, I can't be clever and standoffish with you. I love you too much for that. Too truly, you have no idea how standoffish I can be with people I don't love. I've brought it to a fine art, but you have broken down my defenses, and I don't really resent it. But that given, she then, of course, goes on to write this letter to Violet Trefusis, which just begins, "My darling, it was a real event in my life and my heart to be with you the other day. We do matter to each other, don't we? However much our ways may have diverged," and it goes on from there. Mm. But so you always, you know, have to be careful. But there's also a really funny letter in here from Evelyn Waugh to his wife, who is actually trying to tell her how to write a better letter, which it's sort of hilarious, and it begins, "Darling Laura, sweet whiskers, do try to write me better letters. Your last, dated December 19th, received today, so eagerly expected, was a bitter disappointment. Do realize that a letter need not be a bald chronicle of events. I know you lead a dull life now.
Oh my.
My heart bleeds for it, though I believe you could make it more interesting if you had the will. But that is no reason to make your letters as dull as your life. Oh. I simply am not interested in Bridget's children. Do grasp that. A letter should be a form of conversation. Write as though you were talking to me." And he goes on from there.
Goodness.
But oh, that she was still married to him after getting that letter is sort of amazing. Anyway, these are all from a collection called Love Letters.
Mm, that last one didn't sound like a love letter to me. All right, Nelson, what have you got?
Okay, this is James Joyce's letters. And of course, one of the great fiction writers 20th century, at any rate. So Joyce, there's three volumes also in the Falmouth Library. So this is a letter that Joyce wrote, and I'm always fascinated with the letters that go between authors. And so he writes in November 1926 to Bernard Shaw, once Shaw received the Nobel Prize for Literature. And they didn't know each other well. Shaw had been supportive on Ulysses when it first came out. He had read it in serial form, some of the chapters. But when he was asked to subscribe to the volume when it came out from the Shakespeare bookshop in Paris, he declined. And he said, he wrote back and said, "You don't understand. I'm an elderly Irishman on a fixed income." So Joyce writes to him, "Dear sir, allow me to offer my felicitations to you on the honor you have received and to express my satisfaction that the award of the Nobel Prize for Literature has gone once more to a distinguished fellow townsman. Sincerely yours, James Joyce." That's just a little note. And then, now, Shaw, we don't have his response to Joyce, which is unfortunate. No doubt it would have been humorous. But we do have Shaw's letter to the Royal Swedish Academy on the Nobel Prize. And so this is 18 November 1926. And he says, "The award of the Nobel Prize for the year 1925 to an English work is a very welcome reinforcement of the cordial understanding between British and Swedish culture established by the famous bequest of Alfred Nobel. It will not be lost on my native country, Ireland, which already claims one distinguished Nobel prizeman, W.B. Yeats. It is naturally very gratifying to me personally that it has fallen to my lot to furnish the occasion for such an act of international appreciation. I must, however, discriminate between the award and the prize. For the award, I have nothing but my best thanks. But after the most careful consideration, I cannot persuade myself to accept the money. My readers and audiences provide me with more than sufficient money for my needs, and so as to my renown, it is greater that it is good for my spiritual health. Under these circumstances, the money is a lifebelt thrown to a swimmer who has already reached the shore safely." Mm. Shaw ended up insisting that the money would go, oddly enough, to translating Swedish literature into English. And he, outside of Strindberg, he thought Swedish literature was not terribly literary.
We will have a link to all of the books that we talked about today at our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson Richel, humanities professor at Mass Maritime Academy. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.